This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. It's 6-13-85. We're in hearing room B. We're going to have a public hearing and possible work session on the following bills: HB 2253, 2417, 2428, 2468. Work session on the following: 2007, 2090, 2334, 2359, 2361, 2461, 2510, 2638, 2649, 2670, 2671, 2685, 2757, and 2958. And it's 1 o'clock p.m.
Spread it first.
I don't know.
All right, it's 1:36 p.m., and the Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senators Simmons and Fry are subcommittee of two to hear public testimony on... First, we'll take House Bill 2428, and Representative Campbell is here, and we'll go to, I'll tell you what I'm going to do is, after Representative Campbell testifies, I'm going to move to 2417, so Representative Phillips can testify. Then we'll go back and pick up where we left off, because I know these gentlemen are busy. I hope the audience understands how we're trying to be in three places at the same time. Okay, sir, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much for your time. I am here to propose that you folks act favorably upon House Bill 2428. I'm Representative Larry Campbell from the 43rd District. The bill, and I'm going to take a very little amount of your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to respond to them, because basically it allows for grandparents to petition a circuit court for a right of visitation. It doesn't provide the right of visitation, but it gives them the opportunity to tell their story when they have a difficulty in visiting their grandchildren. And the current law only allows such recourse for parents of a deceased spouse or prior to the final order of a divorce proceeding. And what this would do is it would allow a grandparent who missed that period during the final order of a divorce proceeding, or one who basically has difficulty with their children for one reason or another, to petition the court for the visitation rights. I'd like to just cite a couple of examples in our district, Senator, that one is where a grandparent was denied visitation rights by a daughter and a son-in-law for refusing to provide a deed to some property as an early gift. These folks were not ready to give up their property, but as a result of their refusal to turn the deed over, they were refused future visitation rights for their grandchildren. Another example is some folks from Monroe who have been denied visitation for refusing to testify against their former son-in-law in a divorce proceeding with their daughter. I would say that there are undoubtedly cases where there is reason for a grandparent not to have visitation rights, but I believe that there needs to be a non-biased, non-partisan referee in the case, and I believe that should be the court. Again, this does not provide for the allowance, but what it does do is it allows the grandparents to tell their story and for the court to make the determination. It also identifies that before a child may be taken from the state on a permanent basis, that the court should be involved again in out-of-state visitation rights. And those are the major changes that would be required by this particular law the way it reads. I will say that there have been a number of amendments discussed in this bill. We have worked with those amendments. For example, we agreed to not place step-grandparents in the bill. The bill in its form as it comes to you from the House of Representatives had a very substantial margin. As it passed the House, we would ask that this committee take formal action on the bill and keep it in its present form. Mr. Chairman, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Yes, a couple of questions, Barry. I'm looking, of course, I'm aware of your interest in your work on this bill, and I've tried to follow it along with 300 other bills that this committee's got, but does this allow for grandparents to petition in cases where the children are living happily together, or is it just a situation where the parents have been divorced?
No, this, the way, as I cited the one example, Senator, the case where daughter and son-in-law are living together, there's been no divorce proceedings. In this case, ask for a monetary remuneration, and when that was refused to them, they basically cut off the communication between the grandparents and the children.
Could you point me to the language here where it would provide for an independent proceeding by the grandparents to the circuit court? I read section one as, maybe I'm not reading it right, but I read section one as involving a situation where there has been a divorce, either it's pending or it's been final, but so maybe it's not the right section I'm looking at here.
Well, I'm looking at the second page.
Yeah.
And
I think I can help you now, Larry. I've dug around a little bit here. I think that apparently there was an amendment after the A. M. Grost version.
There is, yes.
Was printed. Yeah, I see.
She just handed it to me. I didn't have it either.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is on page one of the printed A. M. Grost bill, line five after A. Delete the rest of the line. Line six, insert. Whenever the parents or any other persons having custody of a minor child deprive the grandparent of the child a reasonable opportunity to visit the child, such grandparents may petition the circuit court.
All right. Okay. Now, the other question is, suppose that the parents of the child are going to move from Oregon to Colorado, where...
Thank you.
They're going to move from Oregon to Colorado, where mother has been employed... in the philosophy department at the University of Colorado, and this, of course, might disturb the grandparents because the grandchildren now will be a couple thousand miles away. As I understand the bill, the parents actually would have to go to court if the grandparents petition to work out some visitation arrangements. Is that it?
That's it. Merely the visitation arrangements, though. There would not be a denial of the ability to move to Colorado and take the job that time, but it would be basically, you would hope that in a case like that, they would reach agreement on visitation rights, and particularly one that had already been determined by the court.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Senator Hendrickson.
Well, I had some concerns about this, too. I know I was a supporter of the original grandparent visitation, which dealt with the parents of the non-custodial party, because the understanding at that time was the person out of custody might not be able to preserve the grandparents' visitation rights. But I have a harder time understanding why the court should intervene in a family situation with the grandparents, where they are the parents of the person with custody, and why the court should intervene in that situation.
Senator, if I may respond, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned before, I cited some examples. We have a case, for example, in Junction City, where a couple who have children have denied the visitation rights to the grandparents because the grandparents failed to sign over a deed to some property that they wanted. The penalty being paid in that case is between the grandchildren and the grandparents. And certainly, you're right, the court would interpose its judgment in a case like that time, but some of the worst cases that we've identified have been between the parents and their natural children.
Well,
and so what this would do is it would give them the opportunity, and as we say, it merely gives them the opportunity to state their case.
Well, I agree that's a bad situation in a family, but there are many bad situations in families where people don't get along in their interpersonal relationships, where you don't allow a court action. And I was because you can also have situations where the parents may not get along with the grandparents, and they don't want to have interaction, and you're really, in that case, sort of superseding the judgment of the parent.
And
there can be bad reasons and there can be good reasons.
And I guess I would say that some of us have felt so strongly about the relationship between grandparents and grandchildren that we're willing to recognize the potential problem that you legitimately have identified and say that case still needs someone to intercede and review the case as to whether or not the relationship is an appropriate one to continue. And on that basis, there's no question but what it would be the decision of the court. And the court certainly, in a case of this kind, would take into consideration the effect on all the parties. But we believe strongly that opportunity should exist. And that's really what this bill does.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Campbell. And you're free to go back to work. Unless you fellas are through over there or something.
Mr. Chairman, you seem to continue to send us opportunities. So I'll return and see what we can do with them.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing momentarily on House Bill 2428 so that I can accommodate Representative Phillips on House Bill 2417. Question, ma'am?
Yes, I signed up for testimony on this bill.
I understand you did, and you'll get an opportunity to testify
on it.
Yeah. Perhaps you weren't here when I'm
sorry.
What I do is because especially in the last days of the session, everybody's so busy that I'd like to get the legislators back to work again, and so we're going to take House Bill 2428 and 2417, and then we've only got three witnesses on that, and then we'll get back to the other bill, okay? I think that you'll all have a chance here today. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Fry. For the record, I'm Paul Phillips, State Representative from District 9. The bill before you today is a House bill that the House Judiciary spent some time on working with motor vehicles and the Oregon Council of Police Association, the Peace Officer Association, and the Washington County Deputy Sheriffs. The purpose of the bill is to provide an opportunity for a police officer to use their business address on their DMV license and registration. Now, let me explain why. There is potential for all of us to have easy access to one's, if we have one's driver's license, to their personal record and home address. For $2, we can get the entire record. The issue came up in Washington County when a motorcycle gang who was having a undercover operation conducted against them took the liberty to have their gang photographer take pictures of the officers as they were getting off duty, noting that they were getting them as they were getting into their car at an angle in which they could get the make of the car, the driver's license, driver's plate, and obviously had the time of day when they were getting on and off work. And all this was being documented, and then running their plates and getting their home addresses, so they had not only when they were on and off work, but where they lived, and a picture of what they looked like. It was pure harassment of the deputy sheriffs. And nothing ever occurred, and there was no incident of where anybody was set up at their home or anything along those lines, but it was certainly disconcerting to the officers involved. Upon checking, we found some of the Portland police officers that I know and was in contact with had experiences with the same similar types of problems. Now, when we started into that, we wanted to make sure that we didn't hold anybody's driver's record from the public. So we wrote the bill so that if you used your agency, the employment agency, the Washington County Deputy Sheriffs, would have to notify them on a form that DMV would provide that they were indeed a police officer. If there was a change of employment, there was a notification process that would be sent in. We made sure that motor vehicles could administer the program without heavy costs being incurred. We made sure that if you were a process server and needed to contact the officer, that indeed there would be a process in which that could happen. Just for your information, there are potentially 4,200 police officers statewide out of the 1 million driver's licenses approximately that DMV administers. They felt that there was no consistency problem with or administrative problem. For your information also, this is consistent with when an officer files a criminal report, they usually, at least in the jurisdictions that we check, use the business address, their precinct office, for that report too, because that then could be public information. Again, it passed out of the House overwhelmingly. We tried to work out all the kinks so we could send it to you. I will let you know, however, I believe your counsel has been in contact with DMV about a minor change that they would like to make that would all but eliminate all fiscal costs that the agency would incur. I believe that's correct, counsel, is it?
They called this morning.
Okay. Vanita Howard also contacted me and said she would be here to testify today. Briefly, that would be to strike line 10 on page 1 of the House amendments. Calling for renewal every 2 years. They felt that since there was an automatic 30-day notification process that had to occur, that renewal was not necessary, and that, as I said, eliminated all their costs essentially to the program, not completely. With that, I know you're busy and I am busy, and I will entertain any questions that you might have.
All right, thank you. Any questions, Senator Simmons? Senator Hammond? All right, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate having a hearing on this.
Okay, Bob Kaiser.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Kaiser. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Association. We support Representative Phillips' bill, House Bill 2417, and we would like to see it moved out of committee.
Okay. Now, I'm aware that there are two or three different organizations that represent peace officers in Oregon. And the Oregon Council of Police Associations is what? Can you tell me?
It's an organization that represents police officers generally at the level of patrolmen.
Right.
And in some of the associations, it would go as high as sergeant. But basically, what we refer to as the working cops.
All right. Thanks. Any questions, Mr. President? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Vanita Howard, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vanita Howard from the Motor Vehicles Division. HB 2417, as amended by the House, as you've already heard, it allows a police officer to request us to use the police agency's address rather than their residence address. We have one minor amendment that we would like to suggest to the committee, because our analysis of the bill indicates that the amendment would substantially reduce the cost of implementing the bill. That amendment would be on page 1, line 10, to delete the reference to be renewed every 2 years. Any police agency which would fail to notify the division when an officer ceases to be employed by that agency will continue to get a renewal notice from us for both vehicles and drivers. And that, we believe, would provide sufficient incentive for agencies to notify us. You will notice that in Section 3 of the bill, also on page 1, there is a requirement that the police agency notify us within 30 days when the officer ceases to work for that agency. The only other comment we would make on the bill is that there is an error that is repeated back in page 3, line 13, that we detected in the original code, where the term rapid identification appears rather than authentication. That is taken care of in Senate Bill 213, but I thought I should call it to the committee's attention.
All right, thank you. Thank Any you. Questions of Vanita? Thanks, Vanita. All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2417.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Captain Norris of the Oregon State Police did not come to testify, but I have talked to him. He is familiar with the bill and would testify as they are in favor of it.
All right, thank you, Senator.
All right, without hearing scream.
Okay. Well, let's return now to House Bill 2428. And let's see, we have there's one witness owner sign up that didn't give an address, and not knowing where the witness was from, I have to presume the witness is from Salem, probably gets called last, because I'll probably call out-of-town witnesses first. So I'll call Mrs. Foy. Mrs. Foy. All right, Mrs. Foy, come up. You were here promptly, and you signed up first, and you're from Portland, and we're going to call on you first.
HB 2428 does have the support of grandparents groups in Eugene and Springfield. The problem regarding visitation rights affects a substantial number of grandparents, not just a few. I'm convinced it's a nationwide problem, a fact substantiated by articles and by statistics provided me by Grandparents Children's Rights, which is a Michigan organization. Working for stronger laws to solve the heartbreaking visitation dilemma. Nebraska is the only state with no law regarding grandparents, and they're considering a strong one to be voted on next January. 14 other states have excellent any grandparent laws, like HB 2428. The other 35 states do have visitation laws, but mostly inadequate. And I think I've given you a list there of the 14 states in case you do want it. Okay, my husband and myself are delighted with a bill that just passed the House because it would extend the right to any grandparent to petition the court if deprived of visitation by the person having custody of a grandchild. We're distressed by the existing law because while it would provide us with a legal recourse against a son-in-law, we'd have no legal rights if our daughter, the mother of our 4.5-year-old grandson, should gain custody of him and then deprive us of visitation. We feel psychologically blackmailed by our daughter. If we don't cooperate with her, helping her financially to the tune of into the thousands, at least hundreds of dollars, or objecting to anything she does, including the two desertions of her child, she gives veiled hints about possible difficulty in our seeing him. Okay. We have friends in the same situation with their daughter. In their case, it's already occurred, the denial of visitation, the reason for which they can't determine. In our case, the uncertainty is a Damocles sword hanging over our heads. The thread hasn't yet snapped, but our daughter, who deserted her baby, is now divorced, and who lost custody of the child to her husband, is a member of an Oregon cult. I don't really want to elaborate except to say that if a relaxation of the custody situation should occur, which she wants, it's entirely possible our grandson could end up in this commune. We would not be able to gain access in that place. We'd never see this grandchild again, and he'd be as devastated as we would. The love we've given him has helped that poor kid to cope with a disappearing mother, and he still suffers from feelings of insecurity, evidenced by bizarre behavior at times when she is in his presence, and he is emotionally disturbed to some extent, the way he acts. Okay, the provision of the bill not to remove a child permanently from this state without the court's approval is just great, we think, because there's a Los Angeles center for this cult where she is spoken of going at some time. All right. The importance of grandparents in a child's life has been reiterated time and again in studies made by child experts. Dr. Kornhaber, who is director of a New York Pediatric Psychiatric Institute, and Kenneth Woodward, a senior editor of Newsweek, co-authored the book Grandparents, Grandchildren, The Vital Connection, after launching a study that showed grandparents are so important that some of the children interviewed invented grandparents if they didn't have any. And with a rampant number of broken homes and divorces, grandparents can provide an emotional sanctuary. Also, grandparents with visitation rights are in a position to act as an advocate for a grandchild when there's obvious evidence of emotional or physical abuse by one or both of the parents. In our case, of course, it's emotional abuse by our daughter. As for one argument I've heard against this bill, that it would cause hard feelings between grandparents and their grown children. I'd like to suggest that the hard feelings already exist when decent, responsible grandparents are denied visitation. And I have enough faith in our courts to think that they would not grant visitation to any grandparents that are proven less than decent and responsible. And equally specious to my mind is the argument that more marriages would go down the drain if grandparents demand to see their grandchildren. A marriage that fragile would in all likelihood go down the drain anyway. Besides, the problems in most families seem to surface after a divorce and not before. And thank you for your time and attention.
Okay, thank you. Now, let me try to find out exactly what it is you're trying to get at here, Mrs. Foy.
Yes.
I understand your daughter and your son-in-law are divorced.
Right.
And your son-in-law has custody.
Full custody.
Okay. Now, how would this bill help you? And Mr. Foy, he's interested in this also?
Yes, extremely.
Okay. Now, tell me how you think this bill would help you and Mr. Foy.
Well, it would give us peace of mind because attached to the divorce proceedings is an agreement that my son-in-law and daughter signed a year ago, saying that within 1 year they would go. Now, this agreement was only drawn up by a social worker, and our attorney says it is not binding, that it was only a statement of intentions at that time. But they were to discuss joint custody in a year, which is, the year is almost up. Because my daughter, as soon as she found out that our son-in-law was going to fight for this child, he's very devoted to the child, she wanted him. She wanted joint custody, at least. In fact, she asked for full custody, and the judge turned her down flat because of her terrible record as a mother. She left him twice, the first time at 14 months of age. He was afraid of her from that point on. Okay, if she should get joint custody, our attorney said that she would be able to take the child anywhere, including down to this commune.
So your concern then is that someday she may have custody and you want to be able to go to court and perhaps prevent her from moving down to California with your grandson.
Not necessarily California. It's the commune here in Oregon that we have so many problems with.
Well,
I don't want to get sued. I don't have $1 million to answer.
But of course, under present law, if your daughter moved into this commune, you could go into court and ask for visitation rights.
Correct.
Okay.
Because if she's brainwashed to that point, and she's unstable emotionally, she's attacked me physically even on something that we won't go into now, nothing that would be relevant to this.
But if you can go into court now and get visitation rights with your grandchild, I'm still trying to find out what this bill would do for you.
The bill would merely give me peace of mind in case our son-in-law, they're living together again. They're not married, but she went back to live with him. And my son-in-law is rather spineless in regard to her. If he grants her joint custody and she is able to go down to live, she could take the child, we understand from our attorney, and live there. Take the child in with her and live there. And we have no access to him then at that point.
Well, you mean take the child and live in this commune?
Right.
Which is here in Oregon?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, under present law, you can go into court and establish visitation rights.
With our daughter?
With his grandson.
I know, but I understand that we cannot sue a daughter, but we could sue our son-in-law for visitation rights. There's no problem there. But I understand, according to the existing law, we could not sue our daughter, only a son-in-law.
All right. Okay.
Now, that is the problem. We think that any grandparent should have access to the courts to sue either daughter or son or son-in-law or daughter-in-law,
okay,
if deprived of reasonable visitation. But we would have no visitation if she should end up down there with him, with the child.
All right. Any other questions, Mrs. Ford?
Am I correct? I think I'm correct that you cannot sue a daughter or a son under the existing law.
For visitation rights.
For visitation rights.
Is that right, counsel?
Yes.
That's right.
That is our problem, and it's a headache that's ongoing until we have a law in place. Because...
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, now, we have somebody from Lafayette, probably related somehow to Pascal Phillips, but I can't read the first name here.
Pascal.
No, but I mean, who's the other name on here?
Printed that up. It said to print it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So printed. I'm sorry. I wrote it first, and then it said print, so I printed over it.
Okay, fine. It's a good thing you printed it, because I... You and I went to the same school of handwriting.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I am Pascal Phillips, known to many of you as the Secretary of the Committee for Oregon Families, but I was called to testify on this bill somewhat short notice, and therefore I did not have time to consult the committee, and I'm speaking for myself, although I can say that many of the members are in favor of this bill. I would like to mention just two short points. First, the Committee for Oregon Families has worked essentially with abuse and neglect cases.
I can tell you that my father is an alcoholic. My wife's parents are alcoholics. And we have, and I have personally, taken great care to keep my children protected in visiting situations by their grandparents. I respect them, I defer to them, I honor them. But I also do not want my father to be with my children unaccompanied, unescorted, and in situations that I don't know what his behavior will be at that particular time. I also can tell you that my children's grandparent on my wife's side, I remember a Thanksgiving dinner we had at their house, and he turned up the table completely because he was intoxicated. I hesitate to go any further.
Well, I think you've
except to tell you that I'm very concerned personally about litigation that my children's grandparents would have the right to demand access to my children in situations that I could not monitor and make sure that their safety and their mental and physical health was guaranteed. As far as the expertise, I'm a parent. My wife is a parent. She is also in the field of pediatrics. She's also a registered nurse. I have a lot of empathy for the grandparents that have testified here today. However, I can tell you that there is another side of that coin, and that coin is something that I do not want to be in court trying to protect my children from their grandparents. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you for being here. I think that you've expressed a point of view that is of concern, and we need to keep that in mind. I've heard other committee members that have talked about the same kind of concerns as you've expressed to it, and so it's good to have that in the record.
I wanted to know that that's from personal experience. Yes. It's not from something I've read.
That's the best kind of evidence.
And I know that you were looking for that kind of
that's
information.
Right. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
All right. All right, that's going to close the hearing on House Bill 2428. And we've got... just yours here. All right, let me take a peek at that. We've got... Let's take 20... No, let's take 2253. No, let me retrench. Sit down, gentlemen. I've got one witness on 2468, Terry Rogers, and I'll just take care of that now.
We've got another one. Larry Young is here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Terry Rogers from Legal Aid Service in Portland. House Bill 2468 is a greatly shortened version of our original bill, which dealt with the state debt problem, which is the parental responsibility to pay for children that the state is supporting. I won't go into everything we were trying to do. This bill is now very simple and very uncontroversial. It simply requires that the summons in juvenile court matters contain a notice to the parents that they may have to support the child in an out-of-home placement according to the parent's ability to pay. Period. The Attorney General Larry Young, who opposed us on 2468 in the House in the original version, and I wrote this new language, and I thought everything was fine. I saw him up in House Judiciary where he is now. He does have an amendment to propose to the committee, which I am going to take this opportunity to argue against. He wants to add the language.
He's here.
Oh, okay. Excuse me, I didn't see him.
Yeah, he's here.
You said there was one person signed up. Okay.
Well, I did. No,
maybe he'd
I
like
know.
To join us, and then I'll
okay, come on up.
Argue against it.
Lawrence Young. Yeah, he wasn't signed up, but he sent a note up here, so. Go ahead, Terry.
Basically, it is a very simple bill at this time, and a very good thing. People come into the juvenile court. They go through the whole dispositional process over a child, are never told they're going to have to support that child and owe an obligation to the state. 8 or 9 months later, they get a notice that the child has been placed in McLaren. They owe $10,000, and it's going to accrue at $1,100 a month. This will at least give them some notice that there is going to be a separate procedure, possibly later, possibly much later, and that they will have to pay for the child. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead,
Mr. Chair.
No, Senator Simmons.
Terry, what course of action could the parents take if they had such a notice that they don't take now?
Unfortunately, money does become a factor in influencing decisions. If a parent is having a very, very hard time with the child and wants to throw up his or her hands, it may make a difference whether or not the parent will have to support. A parent may feel that, indeed, the parent would like to make another try at keeping the child at home if the parent is going to have to support. We think it is something that people are entitled to know right in the beginning when they are incurring an obligation. Because, in fact, the law says that the obligation to support the child starts as soon as the state begins paying out, whether or not the parent has notice. So I think it is very fundamental for a parent to know that, in fact, right from that moment that the child is placed out of the home, or welfare begins, which is separate from this one, that the child is placed out of the home, that the parent has to support that child.
These people usually come to court without a
90% of the parents appear in these juvenile court proceedings. There's a very high percentage.
Without counsel.
I can't give you a percentage with counsel. Can you? It's nowhere near 90.
Thank you, Mr. All right. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Lawrence Young, Chief Counsel, Family Law Section, Oregon Department of Justice. The Department of Justice concurs with Ms. Rogers' statements that it's important to get notice to the people. And they do not oppose the concept of House Bill 2468. Indeed, I helped draft the amendment. The problem I had after I saw the amendment printed was the question, where is the parent going to be required, or where is that support obligation going to be established? Is it going to be established in the juvenile court, or could it possibly be established using the SED administrative process contained in Chapter 416? Currently, it can be established in either place. The intent of the House Judiciary Committee was merely to require some sort of notice go out to the parent that say, hey, you may be required to pay support at some future date, and not specify where that support obligation would be determined. Ms. Rogers was specifically proposing that it be determined in the juvenile court, and that committee rejected that concept. The problem is, when you read the statute as it's now drafted, there is at least an argument that could be made that the support obligation, because of this notice, has to be established in juvenile court. So the amendment that I proposed is very brief and basically just adds a few words saying you may be required to pay at some future date in a judicial or administrative proceeding.
Mr. Chair.
Just a minute. Let me see if I can put my eye on that. Is that in our book, Counsel?
It's the letter from Lawrence Young, dated June 13, 1985. It says on page 1 of the A. Engross bill, after date. It doesn't say in which line.
It's supposed to be line 10.
Go ahead, Terry.
Mr. Chair, I would oppose this amendment at this time in the session. I think that it is unnecessary because the language itself clearly has nothing to say about where this proceeding will take place. The law is not changed in terms of who has the right to bring the support proceeding, whether it be the juvenile court or the support enforcement division. And at this point in the session, I would be very happy to have a statement of legislative intent, both from the committee and on the Senate floor, that this amendment does not change current state law at all in terms of who proceeds with the support proceeding. But at this point, to have to go back to the House for concurrence, I think is silly when really we're discussing legislative intent. I would ask that an intent statement be made and that an amendment not be adopted.
Yeah. I don't think, frankly, that the amendment's at all necessary, but any questions?
Mr. Chair, I was wondering, too, to what would it mean to a parent to have in a judicial or administrative proceeding? If I hadn't had the privilege of serving in this committee, I probably wouldn't know myself.
Might scare you to death.
Yeah. Well, I'd say, so what? The important thing to me is that I might have to pay.
Yeah. I think the message is there. Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Close the hearing on House Bill 2468. And now we'll go to House Bill 2253. And there are three witnesses signed up, and I assume everybody's on the same side on this. Do the three of you want to come up together? Jim Hennings, Paul Snyder, and Hardy Myers.
Chair and members, Hardy Myers of Portland, for your record. I'm appearing today as chair of the Oregon Jail Overcrowding Project, which is a National Institute of Corrections funded project which was placed in Oregon among one or two other states last year on a competitive selection process to finance what I hope will be a two-year study of the causes and possible solutions to crowding in local correctional facilities in Oregon. It is a first cousin, so to speak, of the prison overcrowding project, which completed its work and submitted a report to this assembly this session. The bulk of our work will lead to legislative proposals for the 87 session. And right now, our work is concentrating on pretrial use of jails in Oregon rather than post-trial. However, the project a couple of months ago centered on the pre-sentence report preparation process as a possible area of streamlining and reform which might help relieve some of the pressure on the existing capacity in Oregon, because a major claim on that capacity is made by people who are sitting in jail awaiting their pre-sentence reports and their sentence, whether it be probation or commitment to incarceration. So the project consulted with judges, with district attorneys, defense counsel, the corrections division, the parole board, and developed what we presented as an amendment, or a substitute, really, for the original House Bill 2253. It passed the House with only one dissenting vote. And it's before you today is what we think is a major improvement in the pre-sentence report process in Oregon, one that should help give us a more efficient use of our existing jail capacity. With that brief background, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask if Paul Snyder would give you a quick overview of the legislation.
Are we looking, should we be looking at the printed House amendments, or should we be looking at the hand engrossed?
Printed House amendments.
The printed House amendments dated June 6th.
Yeah.
That is really the bill now, isn't it?
It is.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Oregon Jail Overcrowding Project. What this measure does is to modify some current practices associated with pre-sentence report writing. Under current law, pre-sentence reports are prepared in all cases in which a felony conviction is involved. When the pre-sentence report is prepared, the full report is prepared in every situation. What we discovered in our context with the various members of the judiciary and the bar is that in most cases, very little of the pre-sentence report is necessary to the judge or to the parties in developing some decision, an informed decision, on sentencing. What we also discovered is that in every situation, the parole board considers it necessary to have all the information from the pre-sentence report in order to make an informed judgment about the length of stay under the matrix. So another aspect that became obvious to us in our deliberations was the fact that there is an incredible amount of Corrections Division field staff work that's involved in the preparation of these reports. And when that time is involved in data collection and data development, that's time that's not spent on supervision of parolees or probationers. So the gist of the proposed amendments, or the amendments that you have before you that were adopted by the House, is to provide first that a pre-sentence report would only be drafted when it's requested by the court or by the district attorney or by the defendant or the defense counsel. When it is requested by any of those three parties, then the court would proceed to what we've designated as a menu approach, so that above what's currently required in the law to be provided in every pre-sentence report, the other aspects of the report would only be written when the court requests it after consulting with the district attorney and the defense counsel. And the final aspect of the legislation that's modified is that under current law, the pre-sentence report format is developed by the parole board in consultation with the Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards. This measure would shift that authority to the Corrections Division in consultation with the parole board after the parole board has contacted the Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards. The reason for that final change is so that the Corrections Division can fit the format to its expedited processing that it's using on computers now. So the net effect of the legislation, as the Corrections Division anticipates it, is to reduce by one half the amount of time that it currently takes for the Corrections Division to do a pre-sentence report for someone who's incarcerated in jail. Another effect of it would be to free up the Corrections Division field staff to actively supervise people who are currently either on parole or on probation, and still protect the parole board by giving it all the information it needs.
Now, Jim, before you start, now, we just sent through a bill the other day, I think it was a House bill, which took care of the, I guess you'd call it a hiatus in the law due to the Supreme Court decision, which said that in murder cases there was no minimum mandatory. Am I stating that right? Okay. Now, so right today, then, we've got no minimum mandatory in a murder case, but in an aggravated murder case, at least one committed before the death penalty took place, we do have a minimum mandatory, but I guess the judge has got discretion to add, 10 years on top of that, Jim, you remember?
It's just a minimum mandatory.
Okay.
He has to give life, he can give a mandatory. But even in those cases, a pre-sentence report is required.
Well, that's the question. That's what I was leading up to. Why should a pre-sentence report be mandatory, which it is now, in those cases where, it's going to be the sentence no matter what the pre-sentence report showed? Is that a legitimate question?
I think it's a legitimate question. It's mandatory if they have just prepared a pre-sentence report and the person comes in on a second conviction a day later. They have to prepare a completely new pre-sentence report.
Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
Jim Hennings, Metropolitan Public Defender. also a member of the Oregon Jail Overcrowding Project. This is a good step towards getting rid of what, quite frankly, is just a waste of time in the system. And what I just said applies. There are times when we just spin our wheels waiting. The amount of time waiting in Multnomah County is 6 to 8 weeks to do a pre-sentence report. This is time in which somebody is sitting in jail, taking jail space at the local area before the judge can decide what to do. And this applies even if a pre-sentence report was done a week before, a month before, a year before. There is no provision even just to do an update. And most of the information, quite frankly, is used only by the parole board. It's not used by the defense, the prosecutor, or the judge in making their decisions. And most of the people who are sentenced, even if they're held in custody, never end up coming down to the penitentiary. They're put on probation. So as a result, information is collected for the parole board, which they don't need because they never see the person later on. Under this bill, those people who are sentenced to the penitentiary would have all of the information collected that the parole board needs, so it would have its information. The impact on this, obviously, for the corrections division is more people out there to supervise people who are on probation, but more important, less amount of time, dead time, of people waiting to be sentenced, which is a very stressful time for those people, very stressful for the jails, and more local jail space. I think it's a very good bill and should be passed.
Well, what about a situation where nobody requests a pre-sentence report and then the judge ends up imposing a period in the penitentiary and there's no information for the parole board to work from?
No, the bill allows, if somebody is sentenced to the penitentiary, then all of that material is collected. Okay. There's no magic in the instant that it's going to be collected. If somebody is sent to the penitentiary, then all the information is collected. But what it means is we don't collect it on every case. Yes. Mm-hmm. When 70 to 80% of the cases don't end in the penitentiary.
Well, I remember distinctly when the law used to be this way, you know, and it wasn't mandatory in all cases. Any questions?
Might add, if I might, Mr. Chairman, that yes. The Oregon District Attorneys Association have endorsed and support this proposal.
I'm glad you mentioned that, sir.
And I don't think the Judicial Conference or either the Circuit or District Judges Associations have as such taken a formal position, but we have been in consultation with various judges, one of whom serves on the project, Judge Sawyer from Medford, Judge Robert Jones from Portland we consulted with.
And Judge Bonebrake?
Judge Bonebrake is here.
He's here.
I believe could, if you wish, share at least or confirm at least a judicial view of the reform.
Sure.
While he's coming, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just for the record, what happens to the current pre-sentence reports that are not used? Are they just in the...
They're put in the file and they're... No. They're put in a person's file, and it's not unusual if somebody has a series of convictions to end up with 5 or 6 pre-sentence reports that just make the file a little bit thicker. They're word for word the same except for the change on what the most current crime is.
Thank you.
All right. Judge Bonebrake.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, gentlemen.
I didn't sign up, but I am Al Bonebrake. I'm circuit judge, and I've testified previously on this in the House. It is a good idea. It would allow that sort of report or that type of information to be developed and incorporated into a report that is necessary to do away with the waste of preparing full reports when full reports are not required or preparing reports when no report is required. It also protects, process in the parole board hearings where they need information, and so when a person is committed to a state institution, a full report would be prepared under this bill. So I think it addresses all the problems. It eliminates waste, but yet provides for that information to be developed for the court or the parole board that's necessary.
Any questions, Judge Bloomberg?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Simmons.
The bill says the report shall contain such additional information as the court may request upon consultation with the DA and defense. Could that also be a deletion of? In other words, sometimes you don't. Do you always need all of the report plus the possible addition, or can you just maybe get by with less than the full report?
I think what's envisioned here is that that what would be developed, if you look on page 2, the very top of the page, the State Parole Board, in consultation with the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards, shall propose to the Corrections Division, and the Correction Division Division shall adopt rules establishing a uniform pre-sentence report form for use, and it goes on. What's envisioned here is that frankly, a bare-bones type of a pre-sentence report would be developed with a checklist of additional information that might be included. And if none of the checks were checked on the form, what they would prepare is the minimum type of report. And I think that's what you were addressing.
That's what I was hoping.
Then it would be an add-on. As if the judge thought it was necessary after talking to the defendant, his counsel, and the state, we could add various areas that might be addressed in the pre-sentence report.
Just reading line 13 by itself, it talks about additional, and it depends on how complete the basic is, whether you want additional or
that's correct.
Take away from it. So I think with that explanation that the hope is that the Board of Parole would adopt rules and their uniform report would be maybe the minimum, and then you could go up from there.
I think that's what's envisioned.
Good.
Judge, are we sidestepping the issue then of the statement of the victim in the pre-sentence report, or do you still, prior to sentencing, consider the victim's statement?
So we will. I think that's required by statute
case. That's what I thought. I was hoping.
I think that would be in the bare bones report. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
It is. Those portions, there are certain portions of the report that are required now by law, and that'll be in the bare bones report.
Okay. That's line 17, Mr. Chair, I think, that whenever it's made, it shall make a reasonable effort to contact.
That's the one, yeah. This is the statute. Okay. All right. Thanks, Judge.
Thank you.
Jack Frost didn't sign up either on this bill, but Jack, unless you come forward, I'm going to assume that you personally are familiar with this bill and you like it a lot. As a senior, are you?
No objection, Bill.
All right, good. All right. We don't have any other witnesses. I want to compliment you people that worked on this project. You know, this is an example of a simple idea that can really make a lot of difference. You know, we keep scrambling around this process trying to figure out the most complicated ways in the world to solve a problem, and sometimes the problem can be solved quite simply. While the bill is a simple solution to a grave problem, it doesn't represent by any means all the great amount of work and effort that you people have put into this entire question of prison and jail overcrowding in Oregon, and the citizens of Oregon have a lot to be thankful for in the volunteered services that all of the judges and lawyers and legislators, Senator Hamby and those people, put into this. All right? Thanks a lot. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2253, and we will... I don't need to be reminded we are now going to be in a work session. We need a quorum. We are going to be in recess until 3:10. 3:10.
Okay, upstairs?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, say, now listen, this bill isn't long ago. Senators Fadley, Brockman, Henderson, Simmons, and Fry, and Hamby. And we will proceed with House Bill 2007. That's a little short.
Shall I explain what it is?
Well, I'll go ahead. Is there some? Oh, there's a Hannon and Gross thing inside the.
Yeah, in the House. House Bill 2007 is a bill that would allow courts to assess costs and disbursements against attorneys whose deliberate misconduct causes a mistrial in a civil or criminal action. The House amended the bill to remove a provision that would also allow the assessment of costs and disbursements against an attorney for the subsequent trial that arose out of the first mistrial.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 207 as amended.
Okay.
We do pass to the floor.
Senator Henderson moves House Bill 2007 as it came to the Senate to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Brockman?
Aye.
Brown? Aye. Bailey?
You really need this bill.
Well,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, I suppose.
Hamby?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Simmons?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye. Well, the answer is no. It's one of those bills that we really don't need. Okay, that carries. 2090.
2090 is the House bill that establishes the Office of the Family Law Commission. It's the one that the committee was talking about yesterday when a call of the Senate came up and everybody took off. There are proposed amendments. 2090-3 that would limit the Family Law Commission to those cases where the value of property involved was less than $25,000, and also that would limit arbitration in domestic relations cases to situations where the property involved was less than $25,000.
What should we be looking at here to start with? Okay. Hand engrossed, or?
It is the easiest thing to look at is the March 1st amendments, because basically they took out the entire bill in the House. So if you look at the March 1st House Judiciary Committee amendments, you'll have the bill, and then you need to look at proposed amendments LC 2090-3.
Okay, now let's see, the dash three amendments, those are Senator Hendrickson.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hendrickson.
I know there's been some discussion among committee members is really the advisability of the underlying bill, in the sense it seems to be creating a new judgeships without really creating new judgeships. One thought I had, and I don't know what the committee might do with it, is to absolutely circumscribe the family commissioners from hearing any trials at all, and limit them to pretrial matters. I don't know if that would allay the concerns of some people that feel it's inappropriate for the legislature to delegate, which is essentially creating another judicial position. I offer that suggestion because it would preserve the bill. It also would address one of the concerns I have, and that is that I think it's improper for commissioners to be probably not only trying cases of large dollar value, but also sensitive issues such as child custody and that sort of thing.
Well, this is one of those bills that I don't think the world would fall in if we didn't get to it at all, but it's here, and so whatever you want.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, if there's not interest in the underlying bill, I would still like to use it as a vehicle to limit arbitration amounts that can be arbitrated in domestic relations to some, perhaps $25,000.